to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're broadcasting today live from the state capitol in Salt Lake City, the opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah Legislature. Our guests this hour will include Senate President Stuart Adams, House Minority Leader Angela Romero, Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden, and Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. You can email me right now to upraccess@gmail.com with your questions. I hope you'll stay tuned for our conversation with various legislative leaders on this opening day of the 2026 session. We'll start with a conversation with Senate President Stuart Adams. I recorded this interview right here about 15 minutes ago. On this part of the program, we're pleased to have Senator Stuart Adams, the Senate President, joining us. President Adams, thanks for joining us.
Great to have you here. It's the first day of the session here at the Capitol.
Yeah, we're live at the Capitol, and it's a big day, obviously. So let me just start, President Adams, with your priorities. What are your top priorities?
Well, before we start talking about priorities, I want to just talk for a second about how exciting it is. This year, we celebrate 250 years of American history. I mean, isn't that cool? Our founding fathers put together this process that we can come up with these priorities, we can meet, we can deliberate, we can find a way to make things the best we can for Utah. It's time to celebrate, I think, 250 years.
Yeah, and there's a lot of celebrations set to happen this year, right?
And when you think about it, you know, America, after 250 years, is still the hope of the world. And if you see what happens in the next 45 days and what's happened over that last period of time, Utah is the hope of America. I mean, yet last year in April, U.S. News for the third year in a row rated Utah the number one state in the country. I don't think it's ever happened in U.S. News and World Report's history. 70 different metrics, I looked at all 50 states, we were number one. At the same time last April, rich states, poor states, they don't look at our history, they look at our future. They rated Utah the best economic outlook 18 years in a row. I mean, America's great, we know that. But the reason America's great is its people, and we have some of the greatest people in America in Utah. So we got 45 days here, and we're going to make good policies that help continue to make America great.
Let me just follow up on that. Famously in Utah, we've had the Utah way, right?
Yes.
A little more compromise, right? A little more collegiality, hopefully, right, over the years. I wonder if that's, in your view, frayed over the last few years, or is it still strong?
Well, I think it's still strong. I mean, you have moments when everybody gets frustrated, and that's part of the process. But I think we need to focus again on what we've done right. And Utah has some of the lowest energy prices in the entire nation. Our electric prices, our natural gas prices, that drives an economy. You know, one of the top priorities we have for Utah is energy development. And we've seen energy, actually no production, very little production of new energy across the entire United States. That's a big problem. Our competitors are developing energy like there's no tomorrow, even though their population is declining. And the reason they are is AI. AI, the country that controls AI, will in fact control the world. And AI needs what? It needs data centers. Data centers need what? They need energy. We're going to develop energy, and we're going to try to move forward and lead the nation in energy development. Just recently, you saw in Box Elder County in Brigham City, we actually permitted nuclear manufacturing plants. They'll manufacture the plants in Brigham City, send them all over the United States, maybe build a few in Utah. But we need to build nuclear energy, because if we don't, we aren't not going to have the power we need to compete with AI.
Now, for nuclear energy, the problems of the past have been regulation, right? It takes a long, long time to get a plant up and running. And waste. Do we think we've solved those problems?
They've come up. We have just north of Utah, the INL lab is the nuclear, one of the lead nuclear labs for the Department of Energy. They have such new technology. They're actually burning the old waste and actually using that in these plants. They're very, very safe. They're small nuclear reactors. The technology has evolved significantly. So some of those issues have been dealt with. And again, We've developed this technology. It's safe, and I think it is the future because it doesn't. It's good, get decent with the environment. It doesn't permit or emit toxins into the air. It's actually a great technology.
So data centers, as you say, need energy, also water. How do we solve the water problem, especially in overall water?
Well, the data centers used to be cooled like a swamp cooler. They used to use a lot of water. Now they're using refrigerated air, and they don't need as much water. So we can develop these data centers. We can develop energy. We are going to lead the world in energy production and in AI development in Utah, and we need to stay competitive with our competitors. The other challenge we have right now, when you look at a global market, is critical minerals. If one country processes or at least mines over 60% of the critical minerals in the world, they process over 90% of the critical minerals. We can't let that continue on. If we don't have critical minerals, it'll shut down our auto industry. It'll shut down our pharmaceutical industry. It'll shut down our economy. We are developing critical minerals in Utah, and we need a national lab here. And we're going to try to get a critical minerals national lab in Utah.
I want to talk about redistricting. This has been a long saga and strong disagreements, I know, between you and the judicial branch, at least some areas of the judicial branch. So the latest, Utah Republican Party is putting forward Prop 4. Looks like they're making some progress. Deadline, I think, on February 14th. Are you supporting Prop 4?
This is a bigger issue than Prop 4. It strikes at the very form of our government. Think when our founding fathers formed our government and passed and came together and put together our Constitution, Benjamin Franklin was asked a question. He was asked, what had they done? And if you remember his answer, it's a famous answer. He said, we formed a republic if you can keep it. And that republic means that you vote people into office and they set the laws. John Adams said a pure democracy, he's never seen one that hasn't committed suicide on itself. It's very easy to see. I mean, you could pass a bill that would do away with income tax. You could pass another referendum, that would actually do double teacher salaries. I mean, representative government is what our founding fathers put in place. A year and a half ago, our Supreme Court changed all that. They changed our form of government, and they moved us from a republic to a democracy. They actually ruled that initiatives were super laws and the legislature couldn't change them if they altered or reformed government. We were under strict scrutiny. Redistricting is just part of the problem, but the bigger problem is our Supreme Court has changed our form of government in Utah, and it has destroyed other states. Senate President in Oregon, he said referendums and initiatives have actually destroyed Oregon. They have one initiative in Oregon that actually changes heroin, LSD, and all the bad drugs into a Class E infraction. $25 minimum, $100 maximum fine, and they basically have legalized heroin in Oregon. Now, if the legislature couldn't change that, they're trying to change it in Oregon, the legislature, they would have basically legalized heroin in Oregon, and it's destroying their state.
Let me just follow up with that. So the balance between, you say that the Supreme Court shifted that balance in a very bad way, you're saying, between citizens being able to directly enact measures through initiatives and referenda, right? But where is that line? If the legislature, some would say, if the legislature can change an initiative, they could enact an opposite.
That's a great question. Let's talk about that for a second, because when Arizona wanted to be a state, they put together their enabling legislation and sent it out for their application to become a state. They had an initiative process in that, and they were denied statehood because Article 4, Section 4 of our United States Constitution guarantees every state a Republican form of government. So they were denied statehood because they had an initiative there. In the 1920s, in the Progressive Era, 20 states put in their Constitution initiatives. They weren't in Utah's original constitution. They got placed in our constitution by a constitutional amendment in the 1920s. Courts have ruled ever since then that the citizens can pass an initiative and the legislature can change it. The legislature changes, the city passes it, they're on equal footing. And that's the way it ought to be. They ought to be on equal footing. Our Supreme Court 18 months ago said, nope, no longer equal footing. You can't change initiatives. Basically destroyed our form of government, moved us from a republic to a pure democracy. And that it will, and you look what's happening in California and Oregon. It's destroyed those two states. Initiatives are not the way to, for government to function. A republic is what our founding fathers put in place. And we need to defend the republic. And I'm not going to disappoint Benjamin Franklin. We're going to try to keep our republic in place.
Speaking of the judiciary, there has been talk of plans to expand the Supreme Court in Utah, add a couple of justices. Is that going to move forward?
You know, we're looking at that. One of the bigger issues is we need to expand our district court and our appellate courts. Everybody's in agreement that we have a backlog of legal cases. And while we're doing it, we're looking at the Supreme Court. Every state in Utah is now 3.5 million people. Most states our size have a bigger court than five. And so we're looking at that. Seven seems to be a good number. Some states have nine. But I know that every issue that is being brought toward a court, there's always two sides to the issue. And right now we're getting almost a unanimous decision out of our five-member court. It seems like there ought to be an opportunity for those, no matter what your opinion is, those who you don't agree with to have a dissenting opinion. I think our court probably needs to, their cases are more complicated. We'll probably look at a seven-member or maybe a nine-member Supreme Court. Mm.
I want to return to water, Great Salt Lake specifically. We had a couple of great water years. Now this one doesn't look so great. And the levels already, you know, back down near dangerous levels. Anything you think is going to happen?
That's a big deal. And we need to fix our water problems. And a year or two ago, we actually put together a policy where we hired a water agent. And that water agent was responsibility to go talk to other states. Water just doesn't be created and is capitalized in Utah. It actually goes into other states. And so we're working with other states to solve our water problems. One idea was when we were in Israel solved their entire water problems. They desalinate. We don't have the ocean, so it's a little hard to desalinate, but California does. And so we're working with the San Diego Water Agency, and they've actually said it's not a bad idea for Utah to build desalination plants in San Diego. You take our Colorado River water, and we can make things make sense as far as trying to create more water. And it's only going to happen if we work with other states. We're in the process of doing that. I mean, we have water problems, and what does Utah do? We always fix our problems, and we're going to go to work trying to fix our water problems.
What's the economic outlook like? Is a lot looking okay? And are there tax cuts on the horizon? What's the budget look like?
Utah has the best economy, like I mentioned before, in the entire nation. Our economy is still growing. The federal government gave us a $300 million tax cut. That's a great thing. And I support that tax cut. We're going to continue to try to find a way. If we can, we've cut taxes again. We've cut the income tax 5 years in a row. We're going to try to measure twice, cut once. We're going to see if we can cut it again. But again, we believe in limited government, free markets. That drives our economy is, I think, what our founding fathers envisioned for this great United States of America after 250 years.
President Adams, anything else you'd like to say here as we head into the legislature?
Welcome to the Capitol. We've got 45 days. It's one of the shortest legislative sessions in the country, and we're going to work hard for the next 45 days, and we are going to keep Utah the number one state in the nation.
We've been talking with Senator Stuart Adams, the Senate President, on the opening day of the legislature. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm broadcasting live from the state capitol today. We're here in Salt Lake City on the opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah legislature. Coming up this hour, we have scheduled House Minority Leader Angela Romero, Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden, and Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. You're able to get a question to these leaders if you email me to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Following a brief break, we'll be talking with House Minority Leader Angela Romero next. I'm Tom Williams. We're broadcasting live from the state capitol in Salt Lake City. It's opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah Legislature. Later in this hour, we'll have Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden, and Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. Earlier today, we talked with Senate President Stuart Adams. Right now, House Minority Leader Angela Romero. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me today.
Appreciate you coming in again. You've been very good to come in on this broadcast for us and on Utah Public Radio. I just wanted to start with an open-ended question. What are your top priorities for this session?
Well, our caucus top priorities are, of course, the economy and affordability. I think if you talk to any legislator, they'll tell you the economy and affordability is up on their agenda. That, and when we're talking about affordability, we're talking about housing. We're talking about just the price at the gas station and how do we address the high cost of food. The other thing that is really important to our caucus is environmental protection, the Great Salt Lake in particular, and just what's going to happen with water this session. How are we going to manage all of that? Education is always huge for us. We don't want to see more money go to vouchers. We want to make sure we keep that money in public schools, and we're supporting our public educators. It's easy to say our public educators get paid a lot of money, but when we're running legislation that kind of ties their hands, do people still want to be in that profession? The other thing is good governance. And what does good governance look like? Do we really need all these bills on elections? Do we need all these bills when it comes to the judiciary? Those are important questions for us, but most importantly for our caucus is inclusion and representation. We've already seen the headlines in the news about certain legislators here who are running bills that limit resources for our LGBT plus community, may tie the hands of communities of color, and attacks on our community members who are aspiring to be citizens that might have mixed status families and that are just trying to provide a better opportunity for their families. And so these are our concerns. And as we go into this legislative session, but as you know, it's a roller coaster ride. You never know what's going to happen.
Certainly is the past 45 days, right? Yeah. I want to start on the good governance side. You're saying we shouldn't, you're wondering why we have all of these bills, right? We just had Senator Adams on. He was making the case for the Republicans in the legislature that the legislature should take precedence over initiatives and referenda, right? Or at least he's saying there should be a balance which balances out the legislature is higher than it is now. I wonder what your view of that is.
Well, every year my colleagues on the other side of the aisle talk about a balance. We've made every loophole. We've run legislation every session to make it more difficult to do that. And this last legislative session, when we went after, well, when the legislature, not all of us, went after public unions, we saw what happened. The community didn't agree with them. And so I think we need to do a reality check as a legislature and say, are we in step with the community? Or is us thinking we are in step with the community? I have great concerns about adding more members onto the Utah Supreme Court and to our appellate court. What, at the end of the day, is this about good public policy or is this about getting our way?
You're on record at an event saying that you are opposed to cutting taxes again. We've cut taxes over the last several years. Post-cutting taxes, I assume that money, in your view, should go to some of these priorities you're talking about.
Exactly. We see the increase of people experiencing homelessness. We see a lot of people in Utah suffering right now because of the economy. Every time we take an income tax cut, personal cut, as I mentioned to the speaker the other day on a panel, $68 for me, I'd rather that go to social services, because when we do this cut, there's a lack of revenue. And then that's why I think it's tied into why we're seeing a lot of municipalities trying to do property tax increases. So we need to think about the overall picture. Who really benefits from these tax cuts? It's not middle class. I'm middle class. It's not middle class citizens of Utah. It's not our working poor. It's not our people that are vulnerable. It's people who are high earners. And so when are we going to think about all Utahns? And so I just don't think when you say tax cut, people are like, yeah, I get a tax cut, but at whose expense?
Mm. So the affordability issues, the housing, food, et cetera, what kind of measures are you suggesting to help with this?
That's a really good question. And I think that's something we have to do and work hand in hand with our local municipalities, because they are in charge of zoning laws. They are in charge of creating those rules. But at the same time, what can we do and how much money can we put in to make sure that we have first home buyer programs, to make sure that municipalities in particular, a lot of times we're talking about housing for my son and for children, but we're not thinking about people experiencing homelessness or unsheltered folk. And so I believe in housing first. Have concerns with where we went with the land that was purchased to provide a campus. And so it'll be really interesting to see as we move forward how we address that particular issue, how we make sure that we don't have a waiting list for people with disabilities. What are these federal cuts going to do to our constituency? We look at the big, beautiful bill, and I know a lot of people don't like to use that word, but that's the word that's used for it. And we're looking at $300 million, $200 million in the next two fiscal cycles that impact Utah. And then we're doing tax cuts. So for me, it's about how can we maybe do preventative measures and maybe look at our most vulnerable. And when you help your most vulnerable and you help people stay out of crisis, you have a more robust community. The other thing is not just home ownership. We talk about home ownership a lot, but what about people that are just renting and all these different fees? My son just recently moved back home with me. He was renting for a while and his rent was just, it kept on going up. But the other thing I noticed is if you're late paying your rent, which we would help him out, people will get fee after fee after fee after fee. And then where do they go? And so these are the questions we have to ask ourselves as legislators. How are we going to make sure that we're protecting all Utahns? And it's not just about home ownership. It's about people who are renting, people who are unsheltered. And where is our budget focused going to be on? Is it going to be focused on nuclear energy? Or is it going to be focused on the Great Salt Lake? So it's very complicated.
Mm. I wanted to, you mentioned the big homeless campus. I know you're not in favor of the part where that's been floated, where some of those beds would go to the involuntary commitment, right? What about the overall campus? You in favor of that?
It depends. My concern right now with this campus and where the site was selected, we need beds. So I'm not going to say we don't need beds and we don't need to address the crisis we're having currently right now. And people need a place where they can sleep. There are a lot of people who are unsheltered who are going to be resistant, and we definitely have to find a solution to that. But I don't know if civil commitment is the route we go. And my concern is that's coming from the federal government. So what I've seen happen in the last year since the president was reelected is just this more police state approach. And so I have concerns with that. And I have concerns with the campus being so far, I have concerns about our ecosystem and our mosquitoes. We're tending to build up in our wetlands in places we shouldn't have had infrastructure to begin with. But my concern is that, are we following best practices? Are there ways to measure whether programs are successful? I just recently returned from Miami. I went down with Mayor Jenny Wilson. We had the mayor of South Salt Lake. We had some different providers and people invested. And we were looking at Miami's model and why they've been successful, where their pitfalls have been, where their success has been. So I'm not saying a campus could work, but we need to make sure we have best practices and we have a metrics and we know it's successful. And that's going to mean investment from the state. That's going to mean investment from our counties and our cities. And so it's going to take everyone investing in that for it to work. And right now, because of the big beautiful bill and these budget cuts we're going to hit from the feds, my concern is, are we able to maintain?
I want to talk about immigration. You brought that up a little bit. ICE enforcement, Salt Lake City, a couple other cities are wanting on a city level to kind of push back a bit on ICE enforcement. You mentioned a couple of bills you're aware of maybe going to be run in the legislature on immigration, playing defense. What do you think the state's role, legislature's role on this particular issue is?
Congress needs to get off their hands and find a pathway for comprehensive immigration reform, find a pathway for our Dreamers, find a pathway for people who have been long-term residents here in Utah, who have lived here in Utah, who contributed to our economy, for a pathway to citizenship. And picking on children and taking services away is not going to be the route I would see us follow. But it's really, we can only do certain things at a state level. This is a federal issue, and our congressional delegation, I'm calling on them, and I'm calling on other congressional members to find a pathway forward for people. Most people who live in Utah have a history. Their families were pioneers, or their families immigrated here to the United States of America. The only people that have claim to these territories are our indigenous populations. I'm Shoshone Bannock. My family was moved on to reservations. And my grandma went to boarding school. So I see what can happen when you have a certain few people make decisions about an entire community. So my concern is these bills are misguided. They're based off of political rhetoric. And what they're doing is they're hurting families in Utah. And we don't want to see what's happening across the country from here to Utah.
Finally, I want to dive in on Great Salt Lake. We had some great water years. This one looks like it's going to be a bad one, and the levels right back down to near crisis levels again. What should be done?
It's a good question. Not my area of expertise, and so I'm going to follow the lead from others, but we definitely have to look at how we're using water and what are ways in which to preserve the Great Salt Lake. I live by the Great Salt Lake. I'm on the western end of Salt Lake City. So the dust monitors that we have been great, but we also have to think about how we are contributing to our ecosystem, like how we look at energy. You know, we have the other side talking about all these different ways in which Utah is unique because we believe in, we have our coal plants and everything. How does that all contribute to the drying of our Great Salt Lake? How does the use of how we get our energy and how we produce our energy, the vehicles we use, how does all of that contribute to that factor as well? And what are ways in which we can make sure that we really are prioritizing the Great Salt Lake and not just saying we are? And we have to have metrics. And there was that great report that I'm reading through right now that talks about ways in which we can do that. And we have the data now to be able to utilize that to make sure we're on the pathway forward, because if the Great Salt Lake disappears, we might all disappear as well.
Yeah. We've been talking with House Minority Leader Angela Romero on the podcast today. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We'll take another break, and we'll be back on our live broadcast from the state capitol with Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're broadcasting live from the state capitol in Salt Lake City on the opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah Legislature. And we bring in now Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden, Weber County, anyway. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I appreciate it. I just want to start with an open-ended question. What are your top priorities for this session?
Top priorities this session are Great Salt Lake, obviously, and all things water. I have four different water bills relating to the lake and the priorities there. And we're also looking at property taxes and affordability is the top of mind for the House Majority Caucus, as is housing.
All right. Yeah. Let me start with Great Salt Lake. Of course, we were crisis mode. We had a couple of wonderful snow years, and looks like we're back to near square one now.
Mother Nature is not cooperating this year. No.
You say you're running several bills. Tell us about this.
So really, in general, what we're trying to do is deliver more water to the lake. And what that looks like in broad strokes is codifying the protocols plan and how we manage the lake when it gets to critically low levels like we're facing, how we maybe do water banking a little bit better and deliver water more shares to the lake, and then just some more dedicated water types of things that we're looking at.
Yeah. There have been some plans floated about loosening up water leases, ways that you could, at least share your water rights. Anything that you're hearing that'd be run on that?
Yes. Yes. One of the bill does exactly that.
It does that. Okay.
It does that.
Great.
Yeah. So that's the water banking and delivering more downstream.
Yeah.
Right?
Very good. So water in general, very interesting to me, your bill about data centers. There's a debate over how much water data centers are using. So tell us what your bill would do.
My bill is focused really on transparency and reporting, because to your point, our state water engineer doesn't really have a handle on what that looks like statewide. I think our municipalities may. But there's a disconnect between what they're gathering when they approve a data center in their local areas and what gets back to the state water engineer. And what my bill would do is require an estimate pre-construction of what they think they'll use, and then ongoing reporting of what they're diverting, what they're using, and then what they're discharging back to the system. So it's really a first step in getting a handle on that. And it's an opportunity, I think, for data centers to tell their story. We have some data centers who have pivoted from being really heavy users of water, where they've found that balance between energy and water, because it is a trade-off for the cooling. And they've got closed loop systems where they're being really good partners with the state. But at the end of the day, I don't think we have enough data to be able to really make sure that most critical resource is being taken care of in a good way. So to me, it's an opportunity for them to report, to be very transparent to the public, and to kind of fill in those missing gaps of what we have and what we don't have.
This would be aggregated data, right? You wouldn't, no one data center would have to reveal their water uses. This would be
every data center would reveal.
I mean, in the final report.
It would all go to the state engineer. Mm-hmm. There have been some concerns in other states that have failed to get legislation across the finish line on data centers. There have been some concerns raised by the industry that it's proprietary information, that it's disclosing intellectual properties. We wanted to be aware of that, and so that's why the public-facing piece of that would be anonymized at the end of the day as the bill moves through the process. If we feel like we need to err on the side of more transparency, that's something that I'm open to. Mm. But I also want to respect the intellectual properties of the industry.
Right.
So
now, some of the older, what I'm understanding from this, some of the older centers use or continue to use a lot of water. Some of the newer ones have done a trade-off. They're using maybe more energy instead of water to cool their systems. I guess that is a trade-off.
It is a trade-off, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and the bill does address some of that. Last session, we did some really good work around large energy users. It seemed like it was time to do some work around large water users. And again, this is an opportunity for the industry to tell their story.
Yeah. With water overall, water usage, we talked about the Great Salt Lake. Of course, we got Colorado River water problems. The states in the compact are failing, at least at this point, to reach an agreement. But overall, is this a consumer conservation issue? Is it a farmer and alfalfa issue? Is it, I guess, probably tell me it's everything, all of the above, right?
Well, I think it is probably all of the above. I think it's interesting. The Great Salt Lake Strike Force just released a study maybe 3 weeks ago where they showed that in the Great Salt Lake Basin, our water usage is shifting. It's us. It's what we're watering outside that is consuming the most water. It's municipal and industrial uses. So we're shifting away from agriculture. We're shifting away from agriculture as a state in general. So And farmers, in my experience, want to be part of the solution. Water is life for them. They're very aware of being of taking care of that critical resource. This is a everybody problem. Mm-hmm. This is an all hands on deck kind of problem. If we could start cutting back even just 30% on the Wasatch Front of the water that we're using, we could deliver more water to the lake. Mm-hmm. So, and it's that outdoor water use that we need to be so aware of. How much are we watering our lawns? And by all indications, this summer is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. You mentioned affordability. We talked with Representative Romero about the House Majority's, viewpoint on this. What about House Majority? What are you hearing on ways to tackle affordability issues?
Affordability issues for us, I think, start with housing, with the basic kitchen table kinds of things. We're focused on trying to reduce regulation to increase supply, reduce taxes where we can. We've got several bills to try to help push back on property taxes. That's largely driven by local spending. There's not a lot of levers we can pull at the state level, but we're looking at some things there. And we're looking at reducing the gas tax, which that impacts everybody almost daily, right? So I think you'll see a package of bills focusing on a number of different kitchen table conversations that are hitting Utahns in their pocketbooks.
Yeah, wonderful. Anything else you'd like to say?
No, thank you so much.
Wonderful. Yeah,
buckle up. Here we go. It's going to be fun.
45 days. Here we go. The first day. I'm Tom Williams. I'm broadcasting Access Utah from the state capitol, or I guess in this segment has been Representative Jill Coford from Republican from Ogden. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
And following a brief break, we'll be talking with Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are today live from the state capitol in Salt Lake City. It's opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah Legislature. We've been talking with Senate President Stuart Adams, House Minority Leader Angela Romero, and Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden. Now we bring in Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming in. So the first question, just open-ended, what are your top priorities and top priorities for Senate Democrats?
Well, our priorities are aligned. We're going to be working on facing Utah's realities for today. You know, our young kids really feel like they don't have opportunities to move forward. We're looking at safeguarding Utah's future by protecting the Great Salt Lake and protecting some of our natural resources, and then also learning from the past and honoring the promises that we've made to our constituents in the past. And so we have quite a few agenda items that span lots of different committees.
All right. Well, let's start with Great Salt Lake. We've had a breathe a little sigh of relief, maybe some of us, with some great snow years. This one looks like it's going to be pretty bad, back near crisis levels for the lake. What should be done?
Well, when we think about what's happening with the Great Salt Lake and how it starts to start spilling dust across our great city here, we really need to recognize that that has to be mitigated, and we need to start funding some of these scientifically based practices that would protect our communities. That would be the first thing, you know, thinking about raising the level, the berm to make sure that one side is healthier, and, you know, listening to the people that are most informed about the Great Salt Lake. One of the things that I was working on is trying to fund the eradication of Phragmites 100%, because that is a water tapping invasive weed.
Certainly so. Are you optimistic about this? The added pressure is we've got the 2034 Olympics coming in. We'd prefer not to have a dry lake to show the world, right?
Yes, I am optimistic. I wish we didn't have to get to the 11th hour, though. I wish we were doing proactive steps on a more aggressive measure.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, and this is, it was a Republican push, but the Utah's universities, this relocation drive. I don't know if you agreed with that in its initial inception. What do you think has happened? Has it been positive or negative?
I was the lone no vote on that bill, and I consistently voted no. It was crafted in a way that put us in a precarious spot. We voted no, and they didn't get their money. We voted yes, and they did get their money, but they had to cut their budgets. So I think it's been a really painful exercise. A lot of our staff didn't feel like they were included in the conversation of how to move forward. And I think it's a bad precedent for our legislature to be dictating how our universities are run. When we think about all the diversity that comes in from all over the world and the ideas that are coming in from all over the world, I think we should be giving that autonomy to our universities. We can curtail the money we give them, but taking money back and cutting their budgets is problematic. We are also looking at a 5% cut in public education, K-12 this year, which is also harmful. You know, if they're going to say they're going to give us money, but then cut our budgets by more, they're not really giving us any money. They're just, they're going to cut us.
What about K-12? What should be the top priorities with K-12 education?
I'm running a bill to bring in a dyslexia screener for all students somewhere between 4 and 6 years old. When you look at some of the audits that have been done, this is one of the major things that they've been asking for that would provide the best good for those of us in our schools that aren't achieving at grade level. So being more precise, looking at what our schools are asking for instead of giving them stuff and telling them what to do. Our school teachers and our superintendents are really educated in how to move the ball forward, and they should be listening to educators in the field.
There are some measures in K-12 to last year, there was a measure passed to have kids put away their phones during instruction time. Right now, I think there's a bill that's going to be run bell to bell, putting away the phones. I wonder if you, what your view on that is, and overall technology in schools.
So once again, I was the lone no on that bill. I think that it's a little heavy-handed, and it's also sometimes a little short-sighted. When we think about what's happening in our schools, our kids are learning how to use devices. And if we teach them how to use their devices responsibly in school, we'll have better citizens. I mean, I'm carrying my phone, you have your phone, that person has their phone. We're all using our phones all day long to connect us to the world that's moving faster all the time. So creating policies and creating educational opportunities for our students to learn how to use their phones correctly seems much better to me. When we have these phones being taken away, our kids can't contact their parents. If there was any kind of threat in the school, we can't reach out to our kids. Some kids use their schools for medical changes. Some kids use it as a translator. Some kids are dealing with younger siblings they need to take care of. So there's a myriad of issues that our kids are using their phones for, and I think it's really short-sighted just to take them away. Also, you can get a waiver. So now you have a teacher trying to mitigate who has a waiver and who doesn't. So I think there's a lot of issues that we need to deal with before we just say bell to bell, take them away. Mm. Also, your phone, can you can take pictures of it, upload it, and you can research things just like I do all day long.
What about social media? Utah has you know, taken moves, or at least attempt to take moves, to restrict the social media use by, you know, kids under a certain age.
Well, I mean, I'm a mom. I have a daughter and a son. I've taken their phones away. When I purchased the phone, I put an app on there so that I could control their phone and turn it off. I think when we're going to say that parents have the ultimate control over their kids and they should be the leading person in their kids' lives, we should leave that to the parents. I've taken my daughter's phone away. I've given her a flip phone. And I'm going to tell you, this is what kind of changed my decisions a little bit, because she had trouble at school because she didn't have a smartphone. So either you create an environment where no smartphones are needed, or you create a situation where we teach our kids how to use their phones appropriately.
Talk about redistricting. Of course, Amendment D 2018 set up the Independent Redistricting Commission. Legislature pushed back on that, at least the Republicans in the legislature. The Supreme Court ruled. And the legislative Republicans don't like that at all, at least the way they ruled. And now this will affect you directly, right? Because you're running for Congress in a new district created under Judge Gibson's ruling. So I guess, first of all, what your view is on this, on redistricting?
I think the people have spoken. That bill won by a majority, a pretty large majority when you consider how many people voted. And that's what we should be doing as we're looking at what's going on right now with the push to put it back on the ballot. They're sluggish with getting the signatures, and I think there's 10 counties where they're really far behind. So it's not popular to take away the voters' voices of who's going to create their maps. I was ready to run in the old map in CD3 under Map C, and now we have Map A and CD1. So I think the people of Salt Lake City deserve to have that representation. I think we're 70% of the GDP, and yet we don't really feel that we are represented in Congress. So I think it's a great opportunity for the people of Utah and the people of Salt Lake City.
It's potentially messy. I don't know if you have any concerns. You said you were set to run under the old map anyway, but if Prop 4 passes, then voters will be voting on the candidates for the districts as they are, and they'll also be voting to abolish that and go back to old districts.
I believe that the maps don't get changed again until we have a redistricting committee. Once the map was in place by the judge. And so the choice is whether we're going to have an independent redistricting committee or the legislator will make that map. That's my understanding.
Yeah. I guess in any case, you'll run your best campaign and
life's
see what
messy.
Happens.
I'm ready.
Yeah, that's right. You're ready. I want to talk about transgender issues. I'm hearing reports that there's going to be further bills run restricting minors access to gender-affirming care, and even one bill potentially being run to restrict adults to similar care. I wonder what your view is on that.
You know, right now in the state of Utah, we have a lot of things that are going on. We have some serious issues that are affecting a very large part of the population. When I think about these bills, I think it's an attack on a very small percentage of our population that also we don't understand. We don't understand all the nuances with gender-affirming care. And so I believe that we should be pumping the brakes on those bills. We should have a better understanding. We should lean into that community and understand their needs better. But I don't see us doing that. I see us just creating ignorant bills that are just harmful to a small percentage of the population. What I would like us to see us doing is focusing on things that are really affecting a large number of people. We have a 30-year waiting list for people with disabilities to get into housing. We have a large percentage of our third graders who can't read. We have an affordability issue for housing and for, those are things we should be taking our time on. And, you know, let's be more educated about that issue. And so we can make thoughtful bills instead of just quick, heavy-handed bills.
What's your view on the bills apparently going to be run affecting the judiciary, adding a couple of justices to the Supreme Court? So that's one side of it. And then there's another bill apparently going to be run which would add judges on the district level.
Well, we're seeing this at a national level and we're seeing it in the state level. You know, just because things aren't working out the way that our majority had planned doesn't mean that we should start manipulating the system. I'm a fifth grade teacher. I talk about the balance of powers in our judiciary, legislative, and executive branch. And to manipulate and strong arm the judiciary isn't effective. And it's also, I think it's a transparent pull power. So I don't believe that that should be happening. I think we should be using the tools we have and working within this framework we have. We have quite a few lawsuits through the state, the legislature versus unconstitutional bills. And this is super problematic.
We've been talking with Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby on this part of the program. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. The session starts, I think, in about 5 minutes. So thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to Access Utah. We've been broadcasting from the state capitol in Salt Lake City, opening day of the 2026 session of the Utah Legislature. And our guests have included Senate President Stuart Adams, House Minority Leader Angela Romero, Representative Jill Coford, Republican from Ogden, and Senate Minority Caucus Manager Kathleen Reby. Our thanks to everyone for their help with the broadcast, and our thanks to you for listening to Access Utah today.